Hi, everybody, and welcome to another Rowing Chat. My name's Rebecca Caro, and today I am joined by Ryan Demain. Ryan, welcome to Rowing Chat.
Thank you.
Now, please tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background in rowing.
I'm originally from South Africa. Came here for a year, and 14 years later, I'm still in the UK. So working at Headington School, clearly enjoying it. It's a great place, and quite a bit of success, I feel. I was a teacher of ICT, but now I'm teacher of PE and performance director at Headington School.
Now, did you yourself row as a young athlete?
Yeah, I started at St. Andrew's College in Grahamstown in South Africa, rowed there for a while, then went to Rhodes University, then joined the national squad, where I was kind of aiming to go for World Student Games and Commonwealth Games. Unfortunately, 5 days before we flew out, my left lung collapsed, and that was the end of my my rowing career. I couldn't do much more after that. Oh, I could have, but I just couldn't afford it, to be fair.
So you and Alex Partridge both, goodness me.
Yeah, about a year apart.
And you're fully recovered?
Yes, fully recovered.
Very pleased to hear that. So let's kick off and talk a little bit about high school rowing in the UK, which is obviously where you, I guess, know most about. What do you think is the current state of rowing at school level in the UK?
I think the three kind of key parts. You've got boys rowing. You've got girls rowing, which I divide into, say, two kind of developing areas. One is obviously the schools, and then you've got the clubs. I mean, I know the boys have clubs on their side. The boys' side has a long established history, and Henley Royal has really helped facilitate that. And now with the girls' side, you've got the schools can really target the Diamond Jubilee Challenge Cup, which is next week, and I think that has seen certainly from my side as a school has allowed for the school to really develop and has helped us retain athletes. On that side, you've also got the club side, which your clubs like Henley have really, I think, developed well off the back of that, and I think it's quite exciting for junior women's rowing in particular. Fingers crossed, there will be a few more events added to the Royal. My hope is a students' event and of some sort, so our athletes have got something to go for, and another junior women's event.
That would be brilliant. So what you're basically saying is that you feel that the National Schools Regatta is getting surpassed by Henley as the premier event that's worth training for?
I think the National Schools has such a broad intake of athletes. You've got everyone from J14 up to J18, and you've got sweep and sculling and all these events that are offered by the National Schools. And the fact that it is so big right now, and the fact that actually National Schools is having to relook at how the competition structure at the event is offered and what we offer at the event is, I think that's a discussion that's ongoing. I'm part of the committee, and there are a number of challenges that we faced with, but it's quite an exciting future, I feel, for junior sports. The Royal, on the other hand, offers that really top end. You know, you get to race international crews from America, from Australia, from all over the world, and it has a very different flavour to anything else that you'd ever experience.
Certainly true. Tell us a little bit about Headington School and the structure of the rowing program. For example, what age do the kids start? What sort of training do they do?
Okay. We start at 11 years old, call it the upper three. It's the first year, our J12s really. They come in, and it's really low key. It is literally splashing around in boats and having a bit of fun. They may train once during the week and then once over the weekend, and the summer months, and then we close shop for them as soon as the clocks change. So we don't allow them to run winter. Same with our J13s. It's all sculling based and really low level, and it's just have a go, have some fun, and see how it goes. When they step up to J14, I say it's a step up, but we really encourage them to do other sports. So, you know, Headington offers netball, hockey, football, swimming, a host of other sports. I'm just literally brushing over a few of the many opportunities they have there. But then when they get to 15, we start looking at things like GCSEs. You have a different structure there. And although we want to increase the training, we're aware that the time restraints on academia has increased through to then J18, where they're on a full program. In terms of our program, we'll train, say, for our seniors, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then on Saturday and Sunday, so they have Friday off. We only train once a day on weekdays, and then on the Saturday and Sunday, it's broken into two sessions, usually typically between 7 and 11 in the morning. For the younger ones, they do a fraction of that. It is a progression that builds through to when they get to the sixth form.
So when you're working with the younger, the J12, J13s, how many children can you accommodate?
We can take as many as possible. I mean, when I first started, we can only have a few. So when I first started 14 years ago, we had 60 girls at best in the club. We're now running at 140 to 150, depending on our intake. School's incredibly supportive in terms of allowing us to take as many, but we've structured the club differently to allow us to do that. So we don't have any additional boats for that or bring in additional coaches. We just we offer certain days, and those girls will pick a day at, that suits them and their other sports. I think the key is when they are 11, 12, 13, 14, they should be doing as many sports as they can do. They should be doing music, they should be doing drama, they should be exploring where their interests are, rather than just what their parent might want them to do, or, you know, might sound like a great idea when they're, you know, 11 years old, but actually they are girls incredibly gifted in drama, and they go off and do wonderful things in dance, and they go do wonderful things. But I think we have to be really flexible. The last thing I want is people doing rowing who aren't really, they're not passionate about it. I think the passion is very important. By 18, then they can do music, they can do drama, they can do other things, but it is limited. We do say at that point, you do need to be selective, because they're doing their A-levels. Okay, then rowing is time intensive. But we're not saying we have to restrict everything, but I'd be lying if I said they could do everything. They can't.
So it's 8 sessions a week by the time you're rising 18.
Yes. Yeah. And 2 when you're 11 years old, 12 years. So when you're J12, J13, in J14, it goes up to 3 sessions during the week. Typically we ask them to do 2 of those sessions during the week. They might be doing another sport, which kind of picks that third session box. And then they'll do, say, a Saturday or a Sunday, but up until April. Then from April onwards, it steps up a bit, in which case they do a bit more rowing during the week, because the other, you know, netball and hockey, they stop during that final term, and rowing becomes the priority.
And it's only 6 weeks, isn't it, up to national schools from
April? Yes. And we did Peterborough this weekend, so that was pretty good.
And how close is the school to the river where you row?
depends on the traffic. Oxford traffic is horrific, so we would do on the weekends it takes 15 minutes to get to the water. During the weekdays it's 35 minutes. Getting there, getting back is a lot quicker, because the traffic's going the other way. We're currently boating out of St. Edward's. They've been incredibly generous over the last, I don't know how many years, 20 odd years, by hosting us there. We've now grown quite big, and we are looking at our own boathouse, and we're developing towards that at the moment.
But you have to drive the kids to the river. They can't get there themselves.
Yeah.
So do you do lamb training as well?
Yeah, 2 years ago, just spent an enormous amount on a gym, and it's an incredible facility. If you haven't seen it, it's really worth coming and seeing. Currently, as far as I'm aware, it is the best girls' school gym in Europe. So they really went to town in terms of planning it. Our ergo room can quite easily seat 30 ergos. You've probably seen some of our stuff on social media, on Instagram and stuff. There's a lot that gets fed through on our social media about where we train and what we do. Hasn't always been that way. We used to train in a wooden shed.
It was a garden shed.
It was a garden shed. But you know what? We loved it. The old girls and the girls who were in transition, even though the girls in transition were going to an amazing facility, that shed was their space, you know. So
out of these sort of 8 sessions that your top girls are doing, how many are on the water and how many are in land training?
Depends on the time of year. The start of the year, we tend to, if I can run through our year briefly, we start off very slowly. I mean, 4 to 6K in the first 2 to 3 weeks. We do a lot of it at S&C. I employ a guy called Barry John Mulder, who is our strength and conditioning coach, and he does some, he does wonders with the girls. And since incorporating a really slower start, we've had far fewer injuries this year. Hand on heart, we've had nothing. We've had no injuries from 15 up to seniors, because those are the ones who do the S&C program, and kind of we bring up really slowly. They'll do 2 water sessions, 2 to 3 weight sessions over that September, October, November session. I say weights, we're not lifting heavy. We've only much later in the year do we actually start lifting something heavier, but I would never say that we actually going to failure in any of the lifts. I think speed of the bar is really important. Takes 0.7 of seconds to get through the rowing stroke. So why should we take 3 seconds to lift a bar off the ground? I think that's just silly, and it's not functional to the sport that we're doing. And I don't think it's appropriate for young developing women who are still growing to be doing that, whether they're men or women. Just that's a personal opinion. And I think we've had a lot of success doing what we're doing. In terms of ergos, we do limit the ergos in the first part of the season, but as the term draws on and the clocks change, then it goes to 4 sessions on land during the week, and those 2 sessions are ergo sessions. Then we replace the water sessions with ergo sessions.
Brilliant. Now, there are schools that are aiming for high performance, like your school, and there are schools that are perhaps a little more focused on participation and in enabling a lot of kids to enjoy rowing. What advice would you give to a school that wants to prioritise participation over high performance as a rowing coach?
Don't do it. Okay, I know this is going to sound really controversial, because there's a lot of sense of let's let everyone have a little bit of a jolly and just try rowing and get as many people participating in rowing, and that's the way to do it. And I see it a lot in girls' schools, they're reluctant to push athletes and create an athlete orientated environment. I have athletes, I call them athletes, whether they are strong or not, but at the end of the day, they are athletes when they walk into our gym, and they all get treated the same. I think that's important. So, you know, rather than holding back your top athletes, you're allowing them to flourish. The participation will happen anyway, and it's like a tablecloth. You pull that the center of the tablecloth up, and everything pulls up. And I think that's probably been where we've had the most success. Is we say to the girls, look, if you turn up, you turn up. If you don't turn up, you don't turn up. Don't expect to be selected for boats. But we do expect a minimum attendance, because it's expensive sports. Parents pay quite a bit of money. But what we find is that there are girls who were hopeless at netball, hopeless at hockey, hopeless at tennis, yet somehow have flourished in rowing. And I think unless you create that environment where you accept everyone, but everyone is treated the same, I think that's really important. Um, And I cringe a bit when people say we are a participation focused club. You're only that if you have limited equipment, limited time, and you want to give everyone a chance as a step into rowing and just give it a go. But then if you want to try that and you're a school that can't offer more, then allow them to go join other clubs. Allow them to go join Henley, Marlow, the great places out there that they can really flourish as a young athlete. But I do think schools can do more to foster that environment of allowing people to compete, because competing is fun. It's challenging, but it's fun. And I think, you know, for me, the fact that we had, you know, we fielded a second eight for X amount of years, is that's a great accomplishment. Because I think for me, seeing a second eight of girls who are training every day, are behaving like athletes, but then going on and doing great things at university, that for me is great. You know, I've got a number of girls who haven't made the first eight, but have gone on to Duke and rowing at a very high level at Duke. I've got girls who are captain of boats at the university, but they're never in the first eight. Unless we fostered that environment where they can be competitive, but also provide opportunity, they would never have got there. And I think that's quite important.
I get it. That's a great perspective. And I certainly respect what you say about treating everyone as athletes and treating them all the same, because it then enables them to raise their expectations. Because none of them have ever been serious athletes before. It's new.
I think most of the time we've got to be very careful about putting limits on young kids. We have to provide an opportunity for them to develop at their own pace. And if we put a ceiling on them, then we're not doing our job.
Give an example of what ceilings there are that people impose. I'm not familiar with these.
I often hear it would come from coaches, parents, teachers. You know, you're doing your GCSEs now. You'll never cope academically. You've got to drop rowing. Now, luckily at Headington, we don't have that. We have a staff body that are very keen to offer opportunities to everyone. And I think that helps the environment at the club. I'm very lucky that I have that environment. But I do know of environments where teachers will say, if you don't quit rowing, you're going to fail your A-levels, or you're going to fail your GCSEs. You can't have that environment and pretend to be successful. And I think when you start putting ceilings on kids, they tend to start believing that. And I think we've got to be careful about what seeds we sow in that light.
So let's just play a scenario here for the sake of the moment. You're a rowing coach. You are keen to have a good performing rowing team. And one of the other teachers is putting one of those sort of limits that you describe on. How do you have that difficult conversation with them?
I think that shouldn't really have to be with the teacher. I think that needs to come from senior leadership within the school, because the senior leadership at the end of the day have a vision for the school, and they're the ones who dictate which direction the school's going in. So fortunately, I don't have that issue. You know, we had a geography field trip once. The headmistress sat down with me and said they need to go on it, and it's I know it's, you know, it ends the day before Henley Royal. And we need to take them on that. So I sat down with the head and said, okay, let's pack a boat up and put it on the trailer, and we'll take the boat to the Alps. And the girls will train in the morning and then do the field week in the afternoon. There's an environment that creates success. I'm very lucky in that way. So, but my head's vision is very clear. You know, we want to provide opportunity for those girls. In another school, I would have to speak to the head and say, what is your vision? Where do you want to go with this? And hopefully try convince them that doing both is healthy.
It certainly helps to teach time management.
Yes, completely.
Now, you mentioned when we spoke before we went live about a concept that I've never heard described before. You called it the athlete scholar. What's an athlete scholar?
I'm going to actually thank Christine Wilson for this one, because she coined it at Oxford, and in her time there, and cheekily cheekily took it off her. Basically, at Oxford, they push the athlete scholar side. And in the USA, they are very much athlete scholar orientated. So if you want to apply to Yale or Princeton or any of those Ivy Leagues or even a top university, it's easier to get in if you're an athlete or have something else, another string to your bow, you know, whether you're a musician or drama or whatever. So we've really pushed this athlete scholar side of things, that you need to be organized, that you need to be on top of your work, because if you're not on top of your work, inevitably it's going to show in your right. You can't hide from that. And you start missing sessions and you start getting stressed, and your performance will inevitably take a dive. So we've really pushed the athlete scholar side of that with our staff, with our pupils, with our parents, and thankfully they've bought into it. I think sometimes they mock me a bit about it, but I think it's important to have, you know, you can be an athlete and you can be a scholar. It's not a choice between two, you know, one of the two.
Do you teach things like time management skills to the girls as part of this?
We encourage it. We do encourage it. I think that's taught very well at the school. I think teachers would be failing if they didn't do that, if they weren't sitting down with them and their tutors, the pastoral heads, whether it's head of year, your tutors, or your deputy head pastoral care. We weren't on top of those things, then I think we'd be failing our students. From our point of view, we do encourage things. So we know where the pinch points are. We know about the January exams. We also know about UCAS applications. And we ask our athletes to start thinking about those things well in advance. So, yeah, we encourage it.
So there's a very nice fluidity, if I interpret what you're saying, between the sporting staff and the academic staff.
Completely, completely.
And do you formalise that in any way, or is it just informal, you chat when you need to?
We plan the year and we think about where our pinch points are. And before those happen, we're having conversations. So we are approaching, your heads of sixth form to talk about university applications, getting their UCAS done. Talking about SATs and when they're going to be sitting there and how they're going to be sitting there, when are they going to go to the US and visit those universities. I think having that plan in place is very important. But I'd say every staff member has a role to play in that. And they are very open. They'll come speak to me and say, Ryan, athlete of yours is struggling here. How can we support them? How can we help them? How can you facilitate in terms of the program, in terms of them catching up with work? And then we can adjust the program so they can miss maybe a Monday and a Tuesday, but then they're back on Wednesday.
Got it. Now, it's often said that school rowing is like an arms race and, it gets more intense year on year. And as a consequence, some children find that they have had enough by the time they have finished school and they don't want to row at university. Have you observed a drop off between high school rowing and university rowing with your athletes?
We had 12 girls racing at Henley Women's this year, old girls. And that was great to see. So, and a number of spectators who had joined us just to watch the event. They're in business now. The oldest lever was 2006, who came to this Henley Women's. Yes, there is inevitably going to be a drop off. University life is different, and my question is always, what can we do to support them in terms of the next steps to that? And I think there's a number of really good programs offering different things. I've got a few girls at Exeter doing some great things under Richard Tinkler. I've got people at Durham. I've had people at Newcastle. They've all had very different experiences. And I think coming back to the school side, if anything that we've done in the last 14 years is actually cut down how much we do. We actually do a lot less than when I first arrived here.
Give an example.
We used to do 3x6K because it was on the GB training program. And although that was good for the GB athletes, who the sparring GB athletes, probably wasn't the right fit for our goals. So we actually we've changed that. We break the ergo up with another form of endurance, whether it's a run or whether it's a bike. Just find that it's just sitting on an ergo for straight set of multiple endurance pieces for young athletes is just boring. So try and mix it up a bit. Another thing is we've changed how we do our weights, we changed how we do our water sessions either. We try vary our water sessions quite a bit in terms of what boats they go out, but there are necessities during the season of what you need to fulfill. I think you know, in terms of cutting down the program, we always try to be as time efficient as possible. Also, it's not just let's get on the ergo and pull hard for however long. You know, that we do a lot of physiological testing to understand where their zones are and what zones they need to be training in.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about the structure of how you set up that physiology testing. I'm guessing we're talking heart rate stuff here.
It goes beyond heart rates. So kind of, I've got a physiology background, and I speak a lot with Dr. Charlie Simpson at Oxford Brookes. He is the heads up the MSc Exercise and Sports Nutrition. So and that's, you know, that's another part of the conversation. But in terms of how I set up the testing, we used to look at the Australian kind of 6 to 8 stage step test, which 4 minute blocks with 1 minute rest between, and an incremental steps that eventually you can plot the lactate and you can get an inflection point, and at that inflection point you can say that is their maximum steady state and you can go from there. I felt that it wasn't working, and work is because I'm dealing with junior athletes and they might not necessarily be conditioned. We adapted that process to work on 5 to 6 10-minute ergos with a minute rest between. Those 10 minutes are done at a very low intensity. We start off at a low intensity, and by half an hour we're essentially you're settling into your aerobic kind of, you know, zones, and that's where we start really trying to find where they should be sitting at, and we'll set based on the blood lactate, we'll set their what watts they need to train at, or a band in which small band in which they should be training at X watts. That really helps formalize the training band for which they should be doing all the endurance pieces. Each athlete's different, so you do have to cater for the athletes, and we do spot checks. So, you know, a week later, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, we're doing spot checks. And also athletes get fitter over time. So if they haven't been ill, then you are slowly stepping it up, and we've worked out how much we want to step up by. But I wouldn't want to give a number, because I think that's specific to even the room. You know, if you do lactates outdoors, you get a different readout. If you do it in our gym, which is we can set the temperature, and we normally set it to 16 degrees. So it gets quite hot in that room. But we got a constant there, and we know what we're looking for. So we know how much they should be stepping up every 2 weeks, and that seems to work for us. We hope.
So you do the blood lactate testing yourself using one of the handheld test kits?
Yeah, the Lactate 2 Pro, and I also have help from some MSc students from Brookes if I need to. I've had a few coaches in the past who were trained by Dr. Charlie Simpson, and that has helped a lot. But it's it is all done with parents' permission, and we send out a formal letter, and kids can opt out at any point. If they're not comfortable with anything, they can opt out, and we'll keep it as open and easy for them. There are other ways of doing it. You can do it with heart rates, similar style tests. You look for an inflection point on the heart rates. You have to plot them. Possibly not as accurate, but you can still get some really good data from heart rates. I would advise watching Stephen Seiler's videos. He has come over to Oxford Brookes, and he is phenomenal. Very much worth speaking to him as a physiologist. He's got some great ideas, especially with heart rate training, and great applications on how to train.
Brilliant. And you mentioned watts as the goal. So the girls' training zones are denominated in watts, not 500 meter splits.
No, we use watts. Watts are a bit more accurate, and keep them on their toes a bit. you know, with splits, it's easier to calculate with WACs, and they don't also understand it too much. So you're not transferring straight to a thinking, oh well, you know, it's 8 splits to this, and then it's another 6 splits to this, and this, and this, and my 2K score. Yeah, I try to avoid that as much as possible.
How do you take watts from the gym into the boat?
Really good question. that's the golden question. I think all your systems, Peach, NK, and then would say you could probably apply it. I am yet to test that. We'll be looking down that route at some point. I kind of go from the premise of Roger Barrows, the South African head coach, and he gave a very good talk in here in the UK. I think it was last year, where he talked about the telemetry they don't have. In fact, their telemetry are just straws on a boat. Then again, you look at Cambridge, they use straws on a boat, so they're doing pretty well. And I think we've done blood lactate in the water, and we use RPE a lot, rate of perceived exertion. And we try to teach our athletes that X training zone, even though, so when we're taking down the data from the athletes on the ergo, we say, okay, we'll take your heart rate, we'll take your rate of perceived exertion, 1 to 10, and we'll take your blood lactate, and we'll take what's you're sitting at. And then we graph it all, and we get a base. We say, okay, this is where you should be sitting for your endurance ergos, and this was your rate of perceived exertion. Actually, that is on rate of perceived exertion, that is a 6 out of 10. And so whenever we say on the water, you should be at a 6 out of 10, because actually outside the heart rates don't marry up to the indoor ergos. They never do. So we use rate of perceived exertion a lot more, and I've taken blood lactate in the water. It's a bit more tricky. But actually, when the girls came into the landing stage after a season, this was in April down in France, we came in, we took a lactate as each one came in. We set them off, you know, a few minutes apart, so there wasn't a log jam at the landing stage. And they were all pretty much in that training zone, very, very, very close to it on both runs, the run down and the run up. And it was an 8K run down, it was an 8K run up at rate 18. So we feel that rate of perceived exertion works really well. Yeah.
I've also successfully used heart rates on the water. Usually in a crew boat, coxswain calls a 15-second, you know, after they've finished a piece, and everyone just takes their own heart rate and calls out the number. And you can pretty much tell if you know the athletes.
Yes, yeah, completely. I think the only where people sometimes go wrong is in an 8 versus a single. You try to get bar pair to hit their heart rates in an 8, it's not going to happen. You know, and they will be giving absolutely everything. So I think we've got to be careful about that sometimes, because from my experience with my athletes, and I really do stand to be corrected, I'm sure I could go down to Caversham and check the GB women's 8, and they'd be all over that, possibly because they get connected better, possibly they can get a hold of it better. I think that's where the differences may occur.
Totally agree with that. Now I'd love to move on to talk a little bit about technique. Do you have a fixed technique that you teach?
I've got a philosophy I try to teach. I think every coach needs a philosophy of some sort in terms of how to move a boat. To sum it up, you could probably speak to any of my athletes. I'd hope they'd answer the right thing. But, you know, we look at, and this is really the older ones I'm talking about here. We talk about relaxation as the top one, and then rhythm, and then efficiency. You can actually row badly with a rhythm and still go fast. And you go to Worlds every year, you see crews winning. You're like, how are they winning that? It doesn't make sense. And it just works because they've got a rhythm. And actually, you look at the fundamentals, and they're quite relaxed in terms of how they move. So I think for me, it's you know, relaxation is the top of the pyramid, and then you find a really good rhythm, and then you have your layers of efficiency, whether it's on the recovery or in the dry phase. And whenever you add those layers, it's trying to do it by being relaxed and with the rhythm and with the boat and with feel. And for me, that's how the boat develops of its speed.
So let's talk a little bit about the drive phase. How does the drive phase work in the Royal Domain School of Rowing?
As simply as possible. Literally place the blade, get a grip of it through the feet. I know we talk about the power curve being this, you know, it's a nice development and kind of, that's how we see it. But I try get the athletes to see it as a build. So, you catch her almost nice and gentle, and then you accelerate that drive phase. You accelerate with the legs, and then, somewhere around three-quarter slides, the hips start opening up, and then the arms follow through at the end of the drive phase. And I know some coaches will teach legs and hips and arms almost at the same time. I tend not to teach that. It doesn't necessarily sit well in my training paradigm, because I think it's easier to teach them that and then the arms coming through. And I think naturally young athletes will do that when they start getting tired and start opening up. So we try and encourage them to focus on the basics of how the movement is created and how the connective length is created, and then we can move from there.
Let's move around the cycle then. Taking the oar out of the water and moving through the rhythm onto the recovery.
Really simply hands, body, slide. I think the more we can separate the back end and then allow the body to be drawn over and get the weight onto the front of the seat and the weight onto the feet so you can feel the boat. And then it's all about feel. Just being really stable, whether it's sculling, just being as still and stable as possible and as flat as possible into the front, as long as they're set up nicely and safely in the lower back. And then really relax shoulders. Everything from hands away, body over should be really still and really calm into the front. I think, just allowing the boat to move. And I talk about boat feel a lot in moving, the boat being a reflection of you, whether it's your emotional state, your kind of how tense or relaxed you are, and actually how it's moving and how you're almost reflecting how the boat wants to move.
And then timing the front end.
That is a feel aspect that is really hard to teach. We start off by saying, okay, let's work on that backsplash and get a nice little splice of the water so you're not pushing before you drive. Inevitably, that spoon touches the water and they start driving, with quarter of the blade buried. And that is a patience that, you watch your top Olympians and they're onto it, and there's not even a backsplash. If anything, it's just straight in. For me, it's just trying to find that connection and that hang and that almost stretch, as long as the lats are engaged and it's being created nice and low. How do I teach it? Just through drills. Loads and loads and loads and loads of drills. I'm a drills-based coach. So I do drills into rowing, feel into rowing, and I think that works quite well.
So what are your top two for that placement?
Top two. If my athletes were watching this, I think they'd have a sweepstake on what they'd be. There's so many because I try vary it. We do everything from slaps, which are pretty good, but it's looking for the crispness of the sound rather than just going through the motion of it, because you can kind of go, and rather than a nice like, and without tension and without force. I like the catch speed exercise. I like just placement exercises. The snap drill, where you kind of roll up and you literally let go of the blade and just drive, and you'll notice that when you drive like that, the blade will pop out of the gate a bit when it connects. You obviously do this in pairs, not as a whole quad. But if the blade kinks in the water, they haven't actually connected it properly. So simple things like that, simple cues that they can understand about what we're looking for. And it's remarkable, you see a lot of people doing that today, but actually they haven't buried the blade or they haven't connected the blade. And although it looks good, suddenly when they put the legs on, the spoon just does that. And I think that's a timing thing that they need to learn and learn how to develop.
So what's the snap catch drill? I don't know this.
I have to post a video of it. So a step draw is a progression from place and then release. You actually place it and then you apply a bit of a force and the blade comes off. You let it slip out of your hands. I learned it from Nick Strange. He applied it when he came and helped me back in 2010. Really good drill, but it has to be timed well and executed well. In an eight, you only do it with, you know, four people on say bar side and then stroke side. Otherwise, you're going to the person's back, or your blade's going to go into someone's back in front of you who does the same drill. In a quad, you can do it quite comfortably. But essentially, it's placed really soft through the fingers. You apply pressure through the feet and you just let it snap off. So it means you are connected. So it's, if you were too tense through the hands, you know, you'd start ripping the water and so. So you want to connect nice and there.
And you actually let the oar kind of pull out of your fingers like that.
Yeah. So literally go boom, makes a big noise. Quite a bit of fun. Really tricky. I haven't done it that much with my school. I tend to do it on longer camps if I'm doing GB stuff. You got 4 weeks. You know, then you run through it really slowly and gradually. You start off with the placements and then you build on the progression until finally you're at Worlds and you. Doing a few of those just as part of your warm up, and then the other side of that is the back end suspension stuff. Teaching them how to suspend with hips and arms only, and then arms only. You know, can they actually sit at back stops and come off the seat just by drawing and connecting through the boats? That I really like.
Now you've got a rather successful quad this year. How many of them were in the same boat last year?
It's been doing all right, the quad this year. It's gathering momentum. It's gathering speed. This year is a brand new quad. There are four brand new girls in the quad. National schools, we were sixth. Had changed two people. And it's added a bit of speed. So I made it to the semifinals at Henley Women's and were beaten by an absolutely classy Henley boat. And you know, you've got some incredibly talented young women in that boat. To answer your question, it's hard to say. We're still building speed, we always look for that final event. So it's hard to say. I mean, last year we had possibly one of the fastest quads we've ever had from Headington. I mean, I think the average erg in the boat was somewhere around 7.12. I've got this sculling trial that we do, and we have a marker that I think up until last year we only had four people go sub that marker, and that year we had three in that boat and one 2 seconds off. One went to the Junior Worlds in the quad, one rode for Switzerland and as a single sculler, two others were too old to trial but were immensely talented young women. And we lost by this much, but a great race from Gloucester Hartbury. Seeing them with their hands and their knees throwing up after the race showed me how much they deserved that race. They wanted it possibly a bit more than my guys, arguably. But a great race from both of them. So this year, I would say if I was a betting man, I'd go for that Henley quad, but there's a good quad from the USA. There's a good quad from Australia. There's a really good Marlow quad that's doing some great stuff. Fortunately, hit the booms at Henley Women's. So yeah, it's anyone's game.
Tell us a little bit about the sort of advanced skills that you work on with these top cruisers. Obviously, you know, they've had 3-4 years training with you and they're getting quite skillful. What sorts of things are you focusing on now as you're coming into the end of the racing season?
I think it's just a confidence in understanding how the boat feels. I always feel that our job as coaches, we can get trapped into the sense of over coaching. And one of my biggest lessons was last year in Lithuania. Had a great quad of four immensely talented young women but we knew when we got out to Lithuania, I had a radio, binoculars, and I couldn't cycle. So, you know, I was at the landing stage at the end of the lake, and they'd come in and I'd say, how did it go? And I'd go, I think we need to work on this and work on this. Okay, go for it. So we knew going into that event that, you know, because you're there for quite a few days, you don't want to get slower. So it was through the whole coaching process was empowering them to make their own decisions and understand how the boat was moving and what they needed to do as athletes and to make the boat go faster. And I would say it was an amazing success. They actually started off the regatta here. They had a little blip and then they just went faster. And you know, I think it was testament to the character of the young woman in that boat. You know, you had people like obviously Danielle Semple, who's now in the under 23 squad. She's been selected for the double. You've got Lottie Orr, who's in the bow of the Henley quad, doing a great job there. You had Phoebe Campbell, who was the fastest non-qualifier in the women's single scull event at Henley Royal now, and she's still a junior. And you had Lucy Edmondson. So very intelligent, but also had the confidence to develop through the regatta. So my job was really a facilitator. I was a sounding board. But I think up to that point was teaching them how to do that. For this year, it's the same thing. It's kind of going, okay, what do you feel? How do you feel it's going? What drills do you think will help? And hopefully that will facilitate that process.
Do they have a speed coach in the boat?
We have two. We have one at stroke and one at two. The one at two is more for feedback about rate. So calls can be called. Speed coach is very difficult on our track because it's, you know, the stream is 6 seconds added on one way and minus 6 seconds the other way. And even then it's, you know, from day to day, it's who knows what it's going to be doing. So it's more an indicator rather than, oh, that's raw speed. So yeah, I think the only time I take real confidence is a stopwatch on a 2K leg.
Yeah, I understand that. But it gives the athletes a measure with which to report back to you is really why I was asking.
Oh, yeah, completely.
Now let's go into lovely Henley match racing. It's a quirky game. How do you teach match racing skills, Ryan?
We do a lot of head races here in the UK. It's a real tricky one because we suddenly get to the summer and then everyone gets side by side and it's a different ballpark. And then suddenly you get to Henley Women's and Henley Royal and you've got, well, you know, one of you is going to win and one of you is going to lose. I think the key is not to ramp it up more than it needs to be. I think for rowing as a non-contact sport, we can't impact on their boat speed. So I always say to my guys is, you know, I don't really care what the result is. If I'm being really honest, I care about what the performance is. You know, what are the processes that are making boat go fast? So if they came off the water and said, you know what, Ryan, I've had the best race of my life, loved every minute of it, couldn't have done more, then great. You know, and for where they are in that time, from what I've developed, you know, with them that season, like last year, that's what they said, they couldn't have done more. And that was what I exposed them to that year. One could argue I could have pushed them harder. I could have let them explore those limits. But I'm it's old school. I'm not that kind of coach. But teaching match racing is more about ignoring the opposition and focusing on what's happening in your boat. I think if they can confidently do that and enjoy being in the environment, enjoy every moment of what is an amazing event, an amazing boat, then I think that should be the focus rather than what's happening over there.
So they have an explicit race plan that you teach them?
Yes, they do. But it's very flexible. We tend not to do pushes. We tend not to do, you know, things that will disrupt the rhythm of the boat. We just try to run race a consistent race, you know, focusing on relaxation, rhythm, efficiency. I think a lot of people like to talk strategy. I just like to talk about going from A to B as fast as possible.
That's a very, very clear message, and I'm sure that everybody could understand that. We're coming to the end of our discussion today, and I just wanted to ask you, if I was to hand you a magic wand and you could change one thing about junior rowing in the UK, what would you focus on?
I feel potentially we as an organization, we almost do a bit too much through the season, too many head races, too much in the winter. So if I was to change one thing, I would actually, if I had a magic wand and a clean slate, move the exams to December would be my magic wand moment. And then actually start the season in January and build through the summer, and then finish somewhere in October time. That's when, I would let, that would be your perfect year. And then November, December is exams, and just doing some training over the exams to keep kids active and involved. That would be my magic one thing. But in terms of events or in terms of organization, I think we're still developing as junior rowing. And I think there's a lot of good ideas out there. And hopefully a lot of people can sit around the table and sit with British Rowing and discuss those ideas.
Tell us a bit about those ideas, because I'm not privy to any of them. What sort of things are people talking about?
I think it's a competition structure. The way the point system works, I think there's some really good things that have come out of it. But I also think that it can be limiting for some crews. Looking at some of the development stuff that we do, there's a really good rowing development guide that's just been produced by British Rowing, and they are amending it. They've been listening to feedback from school coaches. I think that's certainly something that people should consider and look at. I think also we move into because of necessity of river and water, sometimes our competition structure doesn't quite address that. So, you've got, for example, some schools that are two-term rowing schools, some are three-term rowing schools. I think it makes it very difficult to then be competitive and have a fair playing field. But then again, you go to every nation and there's always cards stacked in certain people's favors. I think it's very hard to say. I don't want to speak on behalf of all the coaches, but I think the Kitchen Society is a good avenue for that. There's certain forums in which coaches can address it, and I feel people are listening. So
there's certainly, my feedback is that I observe that school coaches are very honest about whether or not their crew is a first eight quality or a second eight quality, and they don't try and game the system. And that seems to be a very respectful relationship between the racing schools, that you don't push boundaries when you shouldn't. And I think that's a really great sign, as you say, that discussion is informal, fluid, and respectful.
Yeah, I think most of the time that works. Most of the time, sometimes there are crews that should be entering championship when they have entered first dates, and I think that's still an evolution. And I think over time, hopefully, we'll settle on some objective means by which we can determine who should be championship or who should be first date. I also think we could probably do a lot more with smaller boats. And there's the scullery event that's come about. I know we didn't do it this year. I regret not doing it this year, but they've taken some of the events from the National Schools Regatta, and it's 2 weeks earlier, and that's a great forum in which people can get some good high quality racing.
I was thinking a little bit more about what you said about the school year. Now, of course, you're from the Southern Hemisphere. How does the school year and the rowing season work in South Africa?
You cannot do a single sport the whole year, even when you're 18, unless you row for the squad.
That's a rule that is imposed, is it?
Yes, yeah, and there aren't even opportunities to go beyond that. So in South Africa, you start in September time, September, October. Certainly when I was there, it was kind of more October because athletics was in September. But there's now an overlap with athletics. And then they move into the rowing season through to December. December holidays is a big holiday in South Africa. So everyone goes away, and that's a month off. And then around the 4th or 5th of January, they have their 1 week camp. So all the schools will go away, have a camp there. And then they build towards February, beginning of March, they have their National Schools Regatta at Ruta Park Dam. And there's a lot more side by side racing. I mean, you know, if Headington's done, you know, a handful of side by side racing in their short season, there's a race that you can enter every weekend that's side by side. I think now they've moved it a bit, and I think it's now every 2 weeks that there's a regatta, but people race a lot more there. Then after that, they have this national selections, and they can go on and race to be selected as a national crew I think it's around April time, beginning of April. And then they'll train those boats all the way through to the Junior World Championships. And if you look at their results last year, you know, they had a boys single sculler that medaled, a girls single sculler that medaled, a girls double that was really doing well, boys four that did well, and I think it was a boys quad. They had a number of boats out there all competing very well, even though they rode for a shorter period of time. It doesn't always work in their favor. I know they sometimes bring a J16 crew over here for a development camp. I think, you know, in a perfect world, I think the Southern Hemisphere has a gold mine of an opportunity to really develop the rowing system. But they also have a balance in terms of learning other sporting skills. It wouldn't necessarily work here for a single school because, you know, you'd suddenly be taking away that advantage of rowing all year. And that actually has a big gain. What the right answer is, I'm not sure. I'm seeing a lot of old girls growing right into university and beyond. So I don't think they're burnt out.
So in South Africa, you stop after national championships is in March, and then you do another sport right through till September, October time.
Well, they do rugby, and then they'll do athletics or something like that.
And what do the girls do? Do they play rugby too?
I think there are some rugby teams. I think hockey is their main sport, but they also have netball and other sports that they will. I never taught at a girls' school in South Africa, but in netball and hockey are the big things in junior women's sport there.
So a bit of contrast, but obviously some similarities as well.
Yeah.
Any last words?
No, I just thank you very much for having me. Yeah, it's been insightful just sharing some ideas and thoughts.
You've been marvellous. It's been great to hear someone else's point of view, and your honesty is really appreciated. Let the listeners know where they can get a hold of you if they want to contact you.
I'm on Twitter, so that's an easy place. Just search for Ryan Domain. Another avenue is just on the regatta bank. I'm always happy to sit down and have a coffee with coaches and chat through ideas. I've got nothing to hide, to be honest. So more than happy to discuss things with people.
Ryan, it's been a complete delight. Thank you very much for joining me on Rowing Chat.
Thank you very much for having me.
To our listeners, we've got a listener survey going on at the moment. So if you would go to the Row Perfect website, so rowperfect.co.uk/news, when we publish the link to this interview, you will see that there is a listener survey link. We would love it if you would go fill that in. That gives us a little bit of feedback about what you like and what you might like to hear differently, and things that we can improve and things that we can keep on doing the same. So we'd really appreciate you taking 5 minutes to help us out in that regard. And if you enjoy Rowing Chat, please tell your friends and give us a review on whatever podcast download service you like to use. Till next time, it's been great. See you soon. Bye-bye.